Good morning. This is PW Grocer's Environmental Echo Podcast. I'm your host, CEO Paul Boyce, and I just want to welcome you guys to part two of our two-part series here with Dr. Tony Pond from Modern Hydrogen. They are a clean hydrogen company based out of Seattle, and if you were listening to the first half, you're going to be in for a whole tidbit more of information on how this stuff has evolved and its current uses. And I want to welcome you to the show. But before we begin, I just want to remind you, if you want to get a hold of us, always through our website, www.pwgrocer.com/podcast. And we'll dive right in with Dr. Tony Pond. So we mentioned the hydrogen, you know, but you also brought up the solid carbon product. You know, I was on your website and I saw you had nice beakers of just pure black, you know, looks like almost like a sooty carbon product that we've seen before, almost like granular activated carbon. We do a lot of work with the water supply industry, and we use carbon to filter water, you know, so we're familiar with it. But that's looks like what you're getting, a similar product, but I'm sure it's just pure carbon. You know, tell me about the carbon. I see it's solid. Is there any impurities in it? What are you using it for? You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So this, without getting into like too much nerdy detail, like, it looks like activated carbon, but it's not. The particle size and surface properties are different. But long story short, we sell this as a high value material. Some folks will call this like asphalt binder or asphalt extender. So what is asphalt? We all know like that's what's on the roads, right? Like, in fact, you know how like carbon is black, and then have you noticed how like roads are black? It's because roads are made with high carbon content material. But actually, to go into some detail, right? Roads are made with like 90% dirt cheap stuff. It's just gravel and rocks. But the last magic step is that they add in a material called bitumen.
Yep.
It's essentially oil. That's it, like very tarry oil at the bottom of the distillation stack. That is essentially the tarry substance that binds all this aggregate rocks together to form your roads. Over 90% of the cost of the road is actually in this bitumen material, even if it's less than 10% by mass. But also because this bitumen is oil, basically it's one of the grades of oil, it is CO2 intensive. And our material essentially allows the asphalt makers to use less bitumen.
Interesting.
And so,
interesting.
Number one, because it's made of oil, it is expensive. And so we're offsetting one of the most expensive components of making roads. But also because we're offsetting oil, we're also reducing basically all the CO2 emissions embodied in making roads is with the oil component, not the rocks.
Yeah, well,
and therefore, we're also offsetting the CO2 emissions associated with that part. Like, we're also offsetting the majority components of CO2 in the built roads.
Well,
so our clean carbon is both, you know, profitable, you know, right? Like, it's valuable and it's also cleaner for the roads. Now, I will say, I don't think most of the asphalt makers care about like the CO2 component per se. They're just buying this because like we can be an economically competitive source. That helps us reduce their bitumen use. But also because we have finer control over our properties, it turns out we actually have very little impurities because gas is so clean that the official, there's like a few asphalt labs around the country with universities and they've tested our material. We actually make the asphalt stronger.
Well, this is where I was going to go with this. Yeah. You guys actually have a project in, Bexar County, Texas, that you told me about, correct?
Yeah, it's actually pronounced Bear County, which I pronounce it Bexar. But
all right, Bear County, Texas.
That name doesn't make sense. It's San Antonio. it's like the county around San Antonio, the second largest city in Texas. And so we actually have already we have projects of carbon in the ground in 5 U.S. states and also in Canada. But that's one of our publicly announced ones. Because it's in collaboration with the government as well, right? Bear County, the municipality, is also interested in this, and they were an official sponsor of the project. And essentially, we just used our asphalt to do what... and this is also in collaboration with a company called Road Recyclers, which is an asphalt company there. So they get a lot of credit. But essentially, we just teamed up together and did what people want their local city government to do, fill in potholes. We just filled a lot of potholes with our carbon.
Oh, geez.
And we expect those potholes basically to, because our material is stronger, to degrade less over time. So your roads will be stronger over time and cause you less issues.
I believe you guys have recently taken this project when I think it occurred in November of last year. So we're only a couple months beyond that. Do you have any early results on how it's performing or anyone giving you any feedback?
So far, so good. No problems at all. Of course, right? This is road. So a few months isn't going to be enough to test this. Bexar County is monitoring this. This is going to... let's just say, like, we know they're very excited. They even publicly presented on a presentation to a whole pavement industry conference with us recently. But as a scientist, I'm saying, yeah, like, proof will be in the pudding of, like, years of the stuff in the ground, right?
Oh, yeah.
But, of course, official expert and official asphalt labs have tested this, so we're pretty confident this will work for the long term. And the carbon will be locked in there for at least centuries, probably millennia. This is another appeal of this method. Sorry, I'm excited when I talk about a company, right?
No, you got a lot of passion.
Most people who are trying to do this, most people who are trying to avoid these emissions, right, CO2 emissions, are capturing the CO2 from the smokestack, capturing the gas CO2. And then basically they have to inject the gas into the ground and hope it stays there. Which, if you're a physicist, like, yeah, in principle you can do it, but it's risky, like... Gas wants to bubble up, right? You put it into the ground, which is under high pressure. How secure are you about the CO2 not being re-emitted into the atmosphere in the long run?
Well, totally.
Let me ask you a challenge.
A question. If you were going to upscale this and we're going to start, you know, capturing this carbon and collecting it, I guess you call them the box, the unit, you know, what's the best production rate in terms of like pounds per day of carbon do you guys think one of these units could capture?
Oh, our standard size would be capturing about 2 tons of carbon a day. And of course, these are modularized container units. So if you wanted more clean hydrogen, you would just stack the boxes. So you are talking about making many tons of carbon a day, which is actually one of the beauties. It's actually pretty compelling when we show this to customers because traditionally, the carbon otherwise would have burned into CO2. And the nice thing about that for about not worrying about the morality is because it's invisible, you don't see it and it just gets into the atmosphere. But when we capture a solid carbon, now you can see that this is, oh, wow, you're literally like creating tons of this material every day. And if we didn't capture it, it would have all been in the atmosphere. Yeah. You're just using the earth as a giant sewage dump.
So once it goes through your process, now you've got like 2 tons a day of carbon. You know, there's got to be some sort of storage on site, right, before somebody comes and collects it and picks it up and then takes it. How much storage do people usually need, or are you looking to have? Is it cubic yards worth, or is it a truck, a box? How does it get stored?
Think like big boxes, like truck size boxes.
So like a storage container before somebody comes and picks it up?
Yeah, that's right. And I to be clear, right, like we are picking this thing up roughly every week, in some cases more frequently.
Weekly. Okay.
Yeah.
Hopefully you guys are using hydrogen-powered trucks to go get it, and we're not trailing any more CO2 emissions, right? That would be the ideal world.
That's actually one of the bigger parts of our overall life cycle analysis footprints, the fact that you have to pick up the carbon.
Yeah.
But I will say, right, like as with anything in the energy transition, if you do it, like nothing is free. Like the energy cost of building an electric car is also like substantial. Like you always have to break the egg a little bit to make an omelet.
Yes, sir.
But it's about the lesser evil. If you didn't capture the carbon, your two alternatives today would be either trucking in hydrogen or capturing the carbon as CO2 instead and trucking out CO2. Mm. The issue with doing that is that either you're trucking in hydrogen, which is a gas, or trucking away CO2, which is a gas, which is both much less dense than solid carbon.
Yeah.
So roughly speaking, we reduce the truck rolls versus the alternatives by a factor of 10. It's because carbon is so dense. And there's still emissions with that truck, right?
Of course.
I'm just saying.
Of course.
Well, like, if you had to do something, your alternatives today are way worse.
In terms of
their energy intensity.
I mean, I'm really fascinated by this whole thing. This is absolutely amazing, you know. But where's the future? You know, what's the future for modern hydrogen? Do you see potential uses that aren't available now presenting themselves in the future as your technology evolves and advances?
Yeah. So to be clear, we're still a startup.
Yeah.
Our hydrogen projects that are signed are only in 4 states. Our carbon is in 5 states and Canada right now. So just in the USA alone, we have a lot of work to do. In the meantime, last year was the first year where we signed an international deal with a company called Miura. They make half the steam in Japan. So world's third largest economy. So we're also going to be over there. But there's also the rest of the world, right? This is one of the biggest fuel sources on the planet. So we want to expand in the U.S., expand globally. And really, there's still a lot of applications of hydrogen that our product isn't touching. Now, I still don't think in many cases we'll directly touch the end use. The utilities will do that for us. But do as much as humanly possible and quickly. I think if there's one thing that keeps me up at night, like we're still at the very early stages of freaking out manufacturing. And that typically takes companies a long time. And it's crazy, right? I remember the Paris Climate Accords. Like, I think 2016.
Yep.
When everybody, all the nations came together, made their commitments and say, hey, we're gonna aim for no more than 1.5 Celsius by mid-century. Right? That was the Paris Climate Accords. Of course, none of the governments actually met their emissions targets. But the models, reality turned out worse than the climate models. We already hit 1.5 Celsius last year. So we're kind of like, time is of the essence.
Yeah, we don't have a planet B, as they say, right? So yeah, you were correct. I mean, you mentioned you're in like 5 states. Is it all limited to just the West Coast right now, or are you kind of in different areas of the country?
All different areas. Which 5 states did carbon go into? I think it was, Washington State,
of course,
Seattle is.
Of course.
Oregon, California,
okay.
Texas, and Florida.
Oh, good.
We're intentionally trying to do a mix of like red and blue states and purple areas.
I want to see you come here to the Northeast where we're based. That would be really fun to see something like Long Island is starving for it. We could use it.
Yeah. One of our recent investors is National Grid.
They're here. Which, you know it.
Yeah. One of the biggest utilities in New York and Massachusetts.
That's it. That's the national the natural gas guys over here on the island. So we would love to see it in the whole Northeast region. Through all your experimentation and development of these products, have you come across anything accidental or surprising in the lab when you were, trying to, build this product?
Oh, all the time. I'm trying to think about which one I can talk about. The invention process, I will say, right, like with that many patents behind my belt and actually running all these endeavors. Yeah, like... it takes like 100 geniuses along the way. You have your initial idea of how to do it. And right, like pyrolysis go technically, like essentially you heat natural gas in an environment without any oxygen and you heat it to enough high temperatures and it will naturally split into carbon and hydrogen. And of course there was some fancy way we thought about doing that and having very good heat transfer and doing carbon removal from the system. But then you have to constantly invent, because then you realize, hey, like you just can't make, it's not just a core reactor, you have all these peripheral systems that you have to build. And that's not necessarily easy, right? The customer never pays for technology. The customer wants to pay for a full solution end to end. And you need to take care of everything in between. And so without the process or solve it. Sorry, I'm being vague because it's hard. It's tricky for me to describe the actual invention and trade secret that oftentimes is, it's not like someone having a eureka moment. It's people trying different things in a lab and suddenly connecting the knots accidentally.
Yeah, well, I think our listeners would love to hear something like that. You know, like I accidentally discovered X, you know, like the guy that like Bakelite on a you know, the handles on frying pans. They accidentally discovered stuff like that. You know, it's
never like pure accident, right? There's always luck involved, but it's often how to put that analogy. Like I have a specific invention in mind, but I can't tell you what it is. But it's often, you know, like let's say you notice something's happening in a system and it's creating something and it makes X really challenging. But you flip your mentality around that and you're like, wait, actually, if that's happening, why don't I actually use that? Use what's causing me a challenge, rejigger the system so that this goes from being a bug into a feature.
Yeah.
So there's a certain open-mindedness you need to have in the invention process where you can't stay laser focused on what you're solving right now. I know it sounds paradoxical, but you need to like be observant about like the things that are happening in your system. And then sort of break the box and realize, hey, like A, B, and C are happening. How do I rethink what's going on? And then use these as features instead. There's a lot of that in the invention process.
Oh, that's something I have no idea about, but I'm curious like everybody else, right? So it's interesting stuff. Let me ask you one last question before we kind of, you know, wrap up. I don't want to keep you too long. I know you guys are busy out there. We're busy over here. You know, clean energy and regulations or laws, you know, how does hydrogen fit into this? How is it regulated? You know, like the natural gas industry, there's a lot of regulations, right? How does your product fit into this?
So let me talk about both regulation and also policy support.
Sure.
So for example, since hydrogen is used to make fertilizer, we've been using hydrogen essentially for over a century. It's a very mature industry, and long story short, like you don't want to screw around with the hydrogen. It has what is called like a wide flammability limit, but essentially it's very combustible. Right?
That's the feature and the bug. That's why I'm asking all this, for sure.
There's a whole list of regulations that our products meet to deploy hydrogen. It's like things like the fire code, right? Like within anything that has a chance of touching hydrogen, for example, they have regulations on, well, you can't just have like normal electricity wires dangling because what if a spark ignites the hydrogen? So there's a whole list of codes you have to meet. So that's one end. On the other hand, it is one of the most important forms of clean energy. So, for example, the Inflation Reduction Act, the biggest climate bill on the planet right now, is, one many people would argue, the most generous subsidy within the Inflation Reduction Act is for clean hydrogen. There is something called the 45V, which is a direct subsidy for clean hydrogen. And actually, for the most part, the Congress actually engineered it well. It is technology agnostic. Essentially, it's saying, hey, the subsidy will be just CO2 footprints dependent. The cleaner your hydrogen is, we will pay you more in terms of subsidy, and it is nonlinear. You get outsized returns the closer you can get your CO2 emissions to zero. So it's not picking winners and losers. It's not. It's just saying, hey, like actually do the math. Which one of you is cleaner?
Performance-based. Yeah, we can relate to that.
Performance-based.
All right. Well, that's, really fascinating stuff. Tony, before we wrap up, I just want to ask, do you have any last thoughts or ideas you want to share that maybe we didn't cover in our conversation for our listeners?
Your question's phenomenal. I still go back to that food for thought on the infrastructure piece, right?
Yeah.
I don't think most gas pipelines are getting permitted today. So like good luck with hydrogen, but even in electricity, right? Which most studies show you need to double or triple the electricity grid to switch most things over to renewable electricity that can be switched over. So the electricity grid itself is like, again, you're talking about millions of miles.
You know
how many transmission lines were permitted last year? I think 200 miles versus millions. And each one of those permits took 14 years and the other took 16.
Wow.
I forgot specific numbers, but like each one of those transmission lines like took about average 15 years from permit to like from when they started applying to when a permit was granted. So essentially, I'm saying, at least here in the West, either we need permit reform, which we do, but in any case, like we imagine the potential of being able to sidestep that and start reducing emissions immediately, not requiring like any new things to be built, like any new lines or pipes to be built, but a way to start decarbonizing now. That's frankly what I'm most excited about our solution.
Oh, yeah.
Again, goes to that time and urgency piece.
Well, time, urgency, and money.
Yeah, I'm not optimistic, and I kind of get it, right? The politics of building infrastructure is kind of hard nowadays because it's like if you have to build anything, that is transmission or distribution, people always forget about the fact that energy needs to be moved. Sorry, just nerd out. I know we're trying to end,
It's all important stuff. I'm glad you're bringing it up.
Right, like renewable electricity, we all know, has been going down exponentially in price at a point of production. And if any oil and gas company that tells you otherwise, they're trying to mislead you. No, like solar panels are indeed cheaper. But have you noticed your end electricity becoming cheaper in the last decade, last few years?
Like everything else, it's still got my bills go up and up.
That's right. So like what's going on, right? Like something screwed up is going on. So like remember, like energy is not the cost of production. It's a bunch of things added together. It's a whole system. And one of the most important parts of the system is transmission distribution.
That's it, the
today,
delivery.
Just yeah. In the United States, the electricity grid, about half the price of your delivered electricity is already transmission and distribution. It's not generation.
Yeah.
And so it goes into just piece of like, just think about the infrastructure piece of moving all these things around. And these things are very long, right? So when you have to build one, the reason why those projects took forever to be permitted, right? Like a kid could have gone to like high school in that time. It's because they cross many, many different states, counties, cities. If one person like protests in the middle, the whole project's screwed.
It does slow it down for sure.
Right?
We've had it on much smaller projects, of course, yeah.
So we need to think about decarbonization solutions, and we're not the only one. There's many solutions that are kind of smart, but ways to sidestep new infrastructure builds in terms of transmission and distribution. Otherwise, I don't think the energy transition can happen as quickly
as
it is.
It's not going to get off the ground that quickly. You were correct. Wow. Well, Tony, I want to thank you for your time today. I'm sure I hope our listeners got a lot out of this, as I certainly did, being introduced into the hydrogen world here through your company, Modern Hydrogen. So for our listeners, again, our guest today was Dr. Tony Pan from Seattle out there, and his company is Modern Hydrogen. I want to thank everyone for joining us today. And just to wrap up, again, if you guys want to get a hold of us, this is the Environmental Echo Podcast by PW Grocer. Best way to reach us, as I said earlier, is through our website, www.pwgrocer.com/podcast. And we look forward to hearing from you. And I want to thank everyone for taking the time out to listen to this, and I hope you all enjoyed it as much as I did. Thank you. Thank you for joining us on this episode of PWGC's Environmental Echo. You can download and listen to this episode on Spotify, Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, or by visiting our website, www.pwgrocer.com/podcast. For more content like this, be sure to subscribe to our channel and hit the notification bell so you never miss an episode.